This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. Good to be with you today, Matt and Patrick. I'll promise some music coming up here a little bit later on. We got a lot of things to get to. Really, it's going to be a somewhat busy day. There's an outside chance we could be talking to Jack Rice. I'm not sure yet. Hopefully, we get a chance to talk with him. Andrew Gordon of the Legal Rights Center will be talking about protester rights. He's going to do an interview with Brett. Brett, that will be coming up here a little bit later on. But Patrick, yes, you are of course baseball season here. The worst part about being in the Central Time Zone is you got to play these dang Pacific games. So you're going to stay up and watch the Twins tonight?
I actually got to be up in the morning. I'll probably watch a few innings.
We're not a sports station, but I'll say this: you came home. When you got home, you'd won your first two series. You were in the first place by two games. And I know it's early in the season, but you went 2-5 here, or not 2-5, 2-5. You lost out of seven games. You lost five of them at home. Your bullpen looks horrible. You know, a few of your players don't look that good either. Sano is up to a mighty 100. Excuse me. He's not batting 1,000. He's batting 100. It's that time of year. I got to tell you the truth. I went out today. I was kind of, you know, it's been cool. It's, you know, especially after the nice weather we'd had, and, you know, it's, you know, it was feeling cool. And I saw flowers start to pop. That makes me feel good that we're starting to get some color coming up, because let's face it, March for the most part is probably one of the ugliest months of the year in this state. If it really is not a pretty month, it's melting snow piles. It's things are dirty. Everything's kind of dead. And then things start to change in April and things green up and we start getting flowers. I'm really enjoying that. It's nice to get the color, because you know what, this state is, this has been a rough few weeks. Let's just be honest. It has been a rough few weeks with the Derek Chauvin trial of the murder of George Floyd, where we've had that entire incident ripped back open again for us to remember. Of course, the Dante Wright killing in Brooklyn Center. The reality that we have a long way to go here to fix a lot of problems. And I'm going to get into some of these things today. But you want to know the truth is, I will never leave Minneapolis. At one point, I moved back to town here, and I said to my wife, I might move to like a Seattle or a Boston. I liked both of those towns. But over time, I've just gotten to the point, it's like, no, I'm not leaving. Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota is just a brilliant place to be. And maybe the reason why we are dealing with this is a city that seems to be more intelligent and open to change more than I think other cities are. I'm not saying things are great here. I mean, we got a lot of work to do. But I love this town, and I love Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I am not going to just sit back and watch as, even within our own state, politicians attack the cities, you know, who are just looking for quick political points with their base, who doesn't know a damn thing about this town. To the belligerent pro police people who, you know, insist it's all our fault. I mean, my God. I mean, like I said yesterday on the Derek Chauvin trial, I mean, how upsetting was it to have the defense attorney tried to imply that the real problem, the real killer of George Floyd, was the eyewitnesses on the scene witnessing him being murdered by police officers. That was disturbing. We have a lot of problems we need to figure out. And these are not necessarily new problems. I mean, we still are dealing with the atrocious policies. I was talking to someone about the redlining that went on, where the banks and the white population basically you know, downplayed the value of any minority neighborhood in the city, and the repercussions of that still today, the inability to get development in certain neighborhoods, the inability for many homeowners to get, or people that want to buy a home to be able to get credit to do so. You know, those repercussions today, that's still going on. And for us to fix these problems is going to call for some fairly drastic changes. But the reality is, for the most part, and I want to, you know, if I can just talk specifically to the white people here, as a white guy, it's not going to affect you. You're going to still live your life. You'll still live in, more than likely, in the suburbs. You'll still have your car. You'll still have your job. You'll still have your health care. You have all your gadgets. You'll have your golf clubs. You'll have your cabin. You'll have your boat. You'll have your weekends of going out to the special, your favorite clubs to go out there and see your friends. You'll have your bonfires. You'll have your churches. You'll have your life. Just because we are going to try to bring everyone up to the same level doesn't mean you're going to lose anything. So stop freaking out, okay? But the reality is we're going to have to put some Herculean effort in here to change what the hell has been going on in this state and in this country for, well, ever, since this country started, since we stole the land from the Native Americans, since we brought African Americans and other races over as slaves. We, though, have an opportunity here to acknowledge the mistakes of the past. And we can't undo history. You can't undo history. But you can at least acknowledge it and say, what can we do to fix this problem? A lot of the worst things about us as humans comes from ancient and old feelings of superiority and tossed about inferiority to people that the superior ones did not respect. And superior, I'm using in air quotes. The people that place themselves above others. How about I say it like that? These are century-old, you know, bigotry that we have an opportunity to deal with here. And once again, just because we acknowledge, boy, the Native Americans really got absolutely robbed by the white settlers, and this was wrong, and we need to acknowledge this and do what we can to make this better. Just because we go on out there and say, holy God, the legacy of slavery is still with us, just because we have today, and I can look at current politicians who are pushing racism as we speak, that we can look at them, and that's not nuanced political opinion. It's bigotry and racism, and that's that. And the spineless party that will not deal with that. That is the challenge we have ahead. And it's got to be more than lip service. Hey, I'm a talking chimp in here, okay? I am. I can bring up the outrage. I can say this, but you know what? It's going to require all of us to roll up our sleeves and do a lot of work. And maybe that becomes, you know, we have to rethink things like, you know, tearing down police departments and starting back over again and rebuilding police departments and rebuilding the financial structure, or, you know, starting to encourage the idea of multiplexes throughout the city of Minneapolis. Or looking at ways that, you know, we can make good for what happened in the Native Americans. It doesn't mean these are going to be easy discussions. But if we don't have these discussions, these problems are not going to solve themselves. And when you have idiots that sit there and are so threatened by merely us suggesting we refer to some place in the cities by the traditional Native American name that existed for thousands of years before Whitey got here. That's the problem. Doesn't mean that you can't sit there and say, you know, I remember it by the European name that was given, the white name that it was given. But it doesn't hurt that people all of a sudden start referring to a place called Bedote as Bedote. Or, you know, start realizing a guy like John C. Calhoun should not have his name on one of our lakes. But Dave McCosker is much cooler, by the way, FYI. We have a long way to go. We do. We have a long way to go. But once again, I want to make sure I say this again. White America, don't be afraid of this. Don't be afraid of this. It's not going to affect you. It's basically just making sure other people have the same rights. That we can get to a point where someone gets pulled over in their car and it doesn't matter what color they are, what race they are, what religion they are, if they're a man or a woman, or they identify as something else. It doesn't matter. The police just comes up to the window and says, hey there, just to let you know your tabs are expired, but hey, it's been a pandemic, so try to get that taken care of as soon as you can. Thank you very much. And done. And done. There is no gun pulled out. There's no question of whose car is this. There's no question of are there drugs in the car? Just FYI, just more of a courtesy. Just want to let you know your tabs on your car are expired. I don't need to see your driver's license or registration. I just want to give you a heads up. With the pandemic, the DMV has been a little bit hectic, but try to get that taken care of. Just a FYI. All right. Have a great day. Wow! Holy crap! Holy crap! If that could only happen. The United States, as far as countries go, I really kind of place it in that kind of young 20s area where things are not going as we thought they were going to go. You know, you graduate college or you head out into the job market and you think to yourself, you know, this is going to work out well. I'll just kind of do this and this will be my plan and I'll maybe get married and like this. And all of a sudden, you know, you break up with that special one that you've been dating for a few years and you realize that was not working out. Or you basically think the job you're going to work in, my God, you can't stand the job or you can't stand the company you work for. And all of a sudden you say to yourself, oh, now I got to, you know what, I need to go take care of my parents. They live in a town I wasn't thinking of living in, but I need to go back there and take care of them. We're at that point. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, do we want to be one of those people that basically fills ourselves up with bitterness and regret about the hand we've been dealt and sits there and just bitches and moans about everything else, about what everyone else has been doing. And, you know, the reason we're in this place is because of those people. You know, you try to keep blaming other people for what you have done to yourself. Are we going to be that? Or are we going to be the country that looks in the mirror and says to ourselves, you know what? We've screwed up. We've made some mistakes. Dear God, I mean, we've made a lot of mistakes. But we can fix this. We can fix this and we can make ourselves better and we can move on. That's the country we can be. So, it's been a tough few weeks here, folks. I can't speak for other people or their problems. My God, your anger, your frustration, how dare I even question it? Really, how dare I even question it? Because I that hasn't happened to me. So I'm not going to sit there and criticize or critique. I'm just going to, you know, say, you know, we all need to work on getting better. We all do. And we can if we're all committed to it. Now, as I say this, I'm going to take a break. And when I come on back, I'm going to show you an example of not taking care of it, courtesy of Warren Limmer and the Senate Republicans. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. So, you know, I can sit and talk about how we have the opportunity to make things better. But we also have to acknowledge that there, unfortunately, we have a huge problem in this country, and it's the Republican Party. It is. It just is. And I understand you guys are going to sit there, and the Republicans are going to sit there. Of course, Matt says this. Let me explain this. We clearly have a problem with our police departments in this country, and not just in Minneapolis. I mean, the god awful thing that's happened in Chicago, in Virginia. I've often made the point of that. You had the one guy out in what was that town that the guy stole everything, robbed them blind. At the grain elevator, was it Bixby? And, you know, that guy is stealing and destroying the town. And, apparently the police didn't arrest him. It was, gee, Willikers, what are we supposed to do? Meanwhile, I said, if an African-American family stopped in that town's diner and took one penny out of the take a penny, leave a penny container more than the waitress deemed appropriate, there'd be six squads pulled out, guns there, people on the ground saying, you know what you did, full searches. Ugh. We've got a big problem here. Well, the good news is the Senate was talking about the public safety and judiciary funding bill. Okay. All right, great. Kind of opportune time then. Okay, great. We can have a discussion. And once again, I know that the Republicans are in charge of the Senate. I know that the traitorous jackasses Bach and Tomasoni are in there as well. You traitorous jackasses. No. You're not part of the DFL anymore, and you can go away. And trust me, after I read you this story, you'll feel the same way about those two former DFL clowns who got their seats on the DFL ticket and then immediately left the DFL after they won their seats. Yeah. Needless to say, you say to yourself, though, I mean, we clearly have the problem here with Dante Wright. We have this. We can make some changes here. The Public Safety Judiciary Funding Bill cleared the Senate on a 44-23 vote on Thursday, includes money for the court system, prisons, and makes changes to sexual assault laws, including closing out the voluntary intoxication loophole that was highlighted by a recent state Supreme Court decision. All right. Senate Republicans are committed to keeping Minnesotans safe, and this is Paul Gazelka with his blah, 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 blah. But one of those things that was interesting was that as he's claiming they were trying to keep people safe, there was a lot of amendments to this bill that could have been added on that they voted down, including an anti-hate speech amendment, more money for the indigenous women who have been victims of horrible crimes. Nope, those things got voted on. But the one, and I brought this up and I reposted this morning, I brought this up yesterday, there was an amendment proposed that would prohibit police officers from holding membership in white supremacist organizations. Okay. Really? We need to pass this? All right, sure. This should be a slam dunk. It should be a slam dunk, right? It should be. You think to yourself, yeah, Bruce Gregg, yeah, all right. No one's going to really question that one. Well, as predictable, what first happened was Warren Limmer, he said the amendment to prevent, once again, police officers from being members of white supremacist groups, that amendment was germane to public safety budget bill. They had a vote on it, and the entire Republican docket plus traitorous jackass Bach and Tomasoni all voted to vote with the not including in this bill a rule that would prevent police officers from being part of, say, the KKK, the Nazi Party, any white supremacist group. Now, and the argument that Limmer is putting forward is that this is a budget bill. This is a budget bill. This doesn't have any room for policy. And let me repeat what Limmer says here. There's no reference to racism in this omnibus bill, and we can all condemn white supremacy. Funny story, you have a chance to show you actually are condemning white supremacy outside of lip service when you guys are called out on the Senate floor for what seems to be a cuddling, a snuggling up to white supremacy. And even though you scream it there, Mr. Stern Eyes Warren Limmer, you look like a freaking Muppet, dude. Anyway, even though you condemn it, you really did. You had an opportunity to show it, and you didn't. But it's this entire argument that we don't put policy in these funding bills? Because, as you mentioned earlier, we actually had a policy change that the voluntary intoxication loophole. Once again, I'm very glad they fixed that. Holy God, it was hard to kind of believe that a guy could basically rape a drunk woman and say, well, she was asking for it because she got drunk. And that was an abomination. So that getting fixed is there. But that's not a funding issue. That is a policy issue. There's no money that's involved in that. That's just changing. That's a policy change. So Limmer himself is a hack. It also increases penalties on child pornography, sex trafficking, and solicitation of children, and child torture. Harsher penalties for people who sell fentanyl. Increased probation funding to supervise and protect communities where offenders live. Now, that's a funding issue. Expansion of alternatives to incarceration and nonviolent offenders. And appropriations for the Healthy Start Act, a temporary release program for pregnant and postpartum inmates. All right, well, for sure it's the rules on child pornography, sex trafficking, and solicitation. Those are policy issues. That's not financial. Harsher penalties on people who sell fentanyl. That's a policy issue. So your own bill, and I actually talked to two senators. I said, am I crazy? Do these guys constantly put policy issues in these budget bills? They do. So the argument that Republicans are making that they could not ban police officers from being part of white supremacist groups because it was a funding bill, not a policy bill, is just plain bullcrap. But you know what? There is two things that could prove me wrong, and that's what I want to bring up today. I want to give the opportunity to the Senate Republicans, the Republican Party overall, as well as their voters, to prove me wrong. Please, I encourage it. Now, how can they? Well, there's really two paths here. Any Senate Republican, and I got how many microphones, Patrick, do I have in this? I got four microphones in the studio, correct? I got four microphones here.
Plus the fifth one over here.
You got a fifth one there. All right. Plenty of microphones in the studio, right? I will let any Senate Republican come on my show and repeat after me. I condemn all white supremacists. I do not think any police officer in the state of Minnesota, regardless if that's a city position or a county position or a state position, should be allowed to serve as a police officer and be part of a white supremacist organization. And anyone who thinks that a member of the KKK, member of the Nazi Party, member of any of these white organizations that have been deemed hate groups, anyone think that they should, I don't want you voting for me. If you think that I'm wrong, then don't vote for me. Here you go. Microphone, 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 microphone. We'll take your phone call as well there. You can call in. I'll let you go. You can condemn white supremacy. You can demand all police officers who have affiliations with white supremacy groups resign immediately. You can vow to make a law that will prevent them from being able to serve as a police officer in any capacity in this state. And you can tell anyone that disagrees with you that you don't need their vote. Please. I'm sure, Patrick, we have a line of Republican senators out the door. Send the first one on in. Nope. Not one.
Still waiting for their calls.
All right, well, just... Yep. Now? No? You think that if this is like, as Warren Limmer says, we all condemn white supremacy, this should be easy for you, Limmy? Come on down here, you Muppet. Get in my chair here and go to town. Condemn white supremacy. Condemn the KKK. Condemn the Nazis. Demand any officer that belongs to any white power group resign immediately. Write law. I will write a law that says they can't serve as a law enforcement. And if a person disagrees with this, well, then don't vote for me. Come on down. Limmy, we'll get you right away. Not here, huh? Okay.
All phone lines are still open for 90 more minutes.
952-946-6205. This goes for any Republican senator. Heck, I'll even let the clown brigade of Tomasini and Bach come on in here. I'm sure you want to straighten all this up. If you're all against white supremacy, this should be an easy call for you to make. And heck, you're talking to listeners that generally don't get to hear you guys talk directly to them. You should be all over this action. Here we are. Come on down. The Palatial Broadcasting Complex here in Eden Prairie. The other way you could solve this problem, because once again, I have said from the get-go, the reason why Republicans will not solve these problems with our law enforcement groups is because a bulk of the people that vote for them like the police treating the minority groups like they do. They like the way that the black people are treated and the Latino people are treated and the Native Americans are treated and the Asian people are treated. They like that. And so they don't want to change things because they don't want to lose their base. So that's what I've said. But, you know, the other option here is that the voters themselves say, Matt, you know what? You're wrong. You are wrong. I didn't vote for that Republican senator for that. And I will demand that he basically make sure white supremacists do not serve in law enforcement anywhere in the state of Minnesota, or I guarantee you I will vote for someone else. Come, you can prove that to me. But you see, is neither one of those groups is really going to take me up. If they do, I'd be shocked, and I'd love it. Come on down, Republican caucus. I'd love it. Come on down. The water's fine here in the old liberal tank. Come on in, snuggle into your favorite progressive. No, come on down. You want to do this, you can sit right here. Do you hate white supremacy? Yes. Should anyone who is a police officer who belongs to, say, the KKK, the Nazi Party, or any white power group, should they be forced to resign immediately? You can say yes. Should we have a law in the books that say, you know what, we should not have any police officers in the state of Minnesota who are associated with white supremacy groups? You can say yes, of course. And you can tell people that if they disagree with you, that they are more than welcome to find someone else to vote for. There you go. Don't give me this crap about, well, it's a policy issue in a funding bill. That bill is full of policy issues. It is. That's just you guys trying frantically to prevent from having to alienate your base. Like I said, folks, a lot of work to do. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. You know, it's continuing on with, because once again, this Republican bill, which, by the way, Patrick, how many Republican senators got lined up here to kind of condemn white supremacy, demand that no police officer be part of a white hate group? How many we got lined up here?
I can't say if the guy who called was a Republican senator or not, but he did not want to condemn anything.
Was his name Gall Pazelka?
I have to check the log again. Let me. Saul Hazelka, that was his name.
Gall, if you have the gall to call us back, you're more than welcome to. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. I need a shirt that says that. Gall Pazelka. Oh, God, I need a shirt that says that. All right. So I want to touch more here, since obviously we need to fix problems. Because let's face it, the entire point of how Dante Wright got pulled over was racist. That was a racist, you know, entire police activity. You pull a guy once, and I've said this before. You pull the guy over because of tabs. I mean, we're in a state, there's a pandemic. The DMV is way behind on getting cars registered. People haven't been able to do it, so we haven't done that. There's thousands and thousands of cars that have expired tabs. That's just such a garbage reason to pull anyone over at this point. I want to focus on two things, but I think the first thing is there's an exceptional article in the Star Tribune, which is, it talks about, it runs through the video and it shows the difference between the gun and the taser. And quite literally, if you read that article, and I posted it last night, it's hard to comprehend how in the world this officer, Officer Kim Porter, Kim Potter, how she screwed up and grabbed her service weapon as opposed to the taser. I mean, if you know the gun is basically 2 pounds, the taser is 12 ounces. The one is bright yellow, you know, and then there came this point about the safety, and I've been a little bit focusing on this because we talked right away. How did you pull this weapon and have a safety off? And it's interesting because I did some research, and it's important for us to explain two things about this shooting, this death of Dante Wright exposed. One thing is more of a policy thing, but the other thing is just the way the police work. Now, I'm going to get into guns here a little bit, and I know we just had the shooting in Indianapolis. I'm talking about this more in just the process. I have fired a lot of weapons. I was in the military. I have fired a military pistol. I fired an M16, an M60. I have fired a light anti-tank weapon. That was pretty big and cool. But, I mean, I did that stuff in the military. Since then, I haven't fired a weapon, maybe once or twice, but not really. I'm not a person who wants really that much to do with guns anymore. I had enough with them. And when you fire a weapon that's designed to kill other human beings like you do in the military, it kind of puts it in perspective a little bit. So I'm not for it. Now, I'm not against hunting weapons. That is, you know, that's a long-term tradition here in the state of Minnesota. I'm not against hunting weapons. Personal defense pistols, I wouldn't have one, but I'm not against them. I completely am against carrying conceal. That hasn't helped us at all in any capacity. And I'm 100% against automatic weapons. Weapons that when the person sits down with some graph paper and a pencil to design the thing, they're designing a weapon to kill as many human beings as quickly and as fast as possible. Those weapons have no reason to be on the streets in America. They just do not. But I have fired these weapons, and I'm going to go through something here, and I want to talk about, first of all, the safety. Now, the weapons that these people are shooting, the police officers are shooting, are Glocks. I was looking at them like, where's the safety on this thing? And one of the things you realize is the safety is the trigger itself, which is freaking crazy. Now, let me explain why that is. I am right-handed. And if you're watching the show, you can see kind of where I'm going to go with, and I'll use this, and hopefully, you know, I don't get shot. I'm going to use my cell phone as kind of an example of a gun, okay? You grab the gun. I'm grabbing it like the pistol, like this. So there'd be the, like, you got it in your right hand. Now, this is for right-handed people, left-handed people. I know that this is something, it's a little more difficult. Most people are right-handed, and this is the way most of these weapons are set up. On your thumb side of the grip, there's going to be a safety. And it's usually a switch outside of the trigger mechanism. Because what you don't want to do is have people put their finger on the trigger, accidentally fire off a round. So you have a safety that locks the trigger in place and prevents the trigger from being pulled. You have to manually flip the safety to then activate the trigger. That way you prevent it from accidentally firing. That makes sense, Patrick, as I described that there. Does that make sense? It's on the thumb side of the grip. And usually it's a process, and it's not usually a switch that goes easily. You have to really kind of force it down to switch it out of safety. That makes sense?
Yeah, to me it does.
All right. The Glocks that they use, and I think Glock 17 was the one that they described that she is using. The safety is on the trigger. That is a bad idea. Now, I understand why Glock does that, so that if you drop it, it won't go. You have to, basically the mentality they have is that if your finger is on the trigger at all, your intent is to shoot that weapon. Which it is. If your finger is on the trigger, and which brings up another major point I want to get to. I went through the military. I saw a guy. We were in basic training. He was on the firing range. He had his M16. Drill sergeant comes up to him and says, "Can I hold your weapon for a second?" The guy says, "Yes." Drill sergeant takes the weapon and proceeds to beat the living crap out of the guy. Why? Because he had been warned, do not walk around with your finger on the trigger. Because in the military, what they teach you is that if your finger's on the trigger, you're intending to kill something. And so people there don't like it when you walk around with a gun with your finger on the trigger because your intent seems to be to shoot someone with it. You don't put a finger on the trigger unless you want to shoot someone. Which is why our current situation with the Minneapolis police and other regional police departments is a freaking nightmare. How many times have you seen the officers pull the gun and their finger is on the trigger? That tells you the intent is to fire the weapon, not find out what's going on in the car, not find out what's going on in someone's house. Your intent is to fire the weapon. I think the first thing we have to do is get rid of all of these guns where the safety is the trigger. Because that just seems like it's a recipe for freaking disaster. It does. You should never have your finger on the trigger of a weapon unless you're intending to fire it. And when you go and look at the video of George Floyd, when they come up to a guy who allegedly used a counterfeit $20 bill, and they've got their fingers on the trigger and they got their guns out, what does that tell you? They are going there to shoot this guy. Now, they didn't shoot him. They killed him in a different way. But that, regardless, their intent was, because of my military, thank you, drill sergeant, I appreciate what you guys taught me. Because of what they were doing, their intent was to shoot the weapon. That should never be your intent. That should never be your intent. Absolutely not. So, you have to change out these weapons. These weapons, because the safety's on the trigger, you're only asking for people to get shot. Or else you need to go through a comprehensive training and get rid of that warrior training crap that you guys do and teach people the respect for the weapon that the military teaches their people. That you don't walk around, you don't pull that weapon unless you're attempting to. And so if you are a police officer who pulls over someone like Dante Wright, and you pull that weapon and you put your finger on the trigger, you need to be asked that second, why are you thinking of shooting him? Why are you thinking of shooting him? Because that's what your intent is when your finger's on the trigger. I think it's clear to me at this point they have to revisit the types of weapons they're allowing and get a weapon that has that feature where the safety is not the trigger. It's off to the side. It is something they have to switch manually, because you know what? Without that, I don't trust police officers with guns right now. If their finger is automatically on the trigger, that's a huge freaking problem. So you put that safety on the side, they can sit there and put their finger on the trigger all the time, but it's not going to pull because the safety's on. If you got the safety on the trigger itself, well, once you pull in slightly, you activate the trigger, you deactivate the safety so the trigger's live. That's insanity. That's just really stupid if you want to know the truth. And the fact that I can say that as a military guy, my God. Army guys are in combat. The job of the military is to fight wars. When they are more weapon conscious and safe with their guns around people for their job than the police are patrolling the streets of Minneapolis and the suburbs, that's got to tell you something. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Special message to Patrick. We were going to get Jack Rice at 5. After Jack, we're going to have the Brett's interview. More music as well coming up today. I got a disturbing story, though, about the press and how they're being treated here. I got to get to that as well today. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. They're running odds on the chance of any Republican ever showing up from one of my show. Come on in. Let's snuggle. 952-946-6205. Bob is in Minneapolis. Let's take his call here. Welcome on in, Bob.
Hey, Matt. Hey. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, sir.
Okay, awesome. Just wanted to, you know, revisit the purpose of a safety. You had mentioned it, but it kind of got glazed over. I am about as lefty as they come. I'm also a concealed carry permit holder. My initial training on that was that the safety mechanism, I've got a weapon similar to the Glock 17. It's actually two-part, so where the web between your thumb and forefinger activates the first part, and then there's a little part in the trigger that's the second part.
When I was looking at the guns online that the police are using, I kept looking for something like that, because when I saw that trigger one, I said, there's got to be a different one on here, but there didn't seem to be one.
It's very subtle, and I'm not a Glock owner. I've got a different but similar style. But we were told it's not to prevent you from firing it, because if you're drawing your weapon, yeah, you're thinking you're going to need to fire it. It's to prevent accidental discharge. So if you've got it bumping around in your trunk, you don't shoot yourself in the back.
Well, yeah. The guys that basically drop it in a church and end up shooting themselves. Yeah, that's a big part of it as well. No, the guns that I saw, and thanks Bob. The ones I saw, the safety is on the trigger, and that's insanity. Your only time your finger should go on that trigger is when your intent to fire is confirmed. And you know, he actually just said it. You don't pull that weapon unless you want to use it. So that gun should not even be out of your holster unless you're saying to yourself, oh, I might need to kill a person today. And I think it's too much of a video game culture, I think, right now with these police departments. I really do. And that's not trying to be glib with it, but that's kind of the mentality. I don't think they understand the weapon that they have in their hands. 952-946-6205. The Office of Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison is opposing a motion that seeks to exempt journalists from arrest or use of force during protests. What? In June, the ACLU sued law enforcement in the city of Minneapolis for allegedly targeting journalists trying to cover protests after the death of George Floyd, seeking damage for injured journalists and a temporary restraining order banned to law enforcement from using force, including tear gas and rubber bullets against the media. They said that police actions violated the First, Fourth, and 14th Amendments. Now Ellison is arguing the court should deny similar motion from a group of journalists for a temporary restraining order against law enforcement in the wake of protests over the killing of Dante Wright. They say there is no precedent for First Amendment protection against a dispersal order. What? The media is not and cannot be exempt from dispersal orders, according to a brief filed by Ellison's office in its role as legal counsel for the Department of Public Safety. Law enforcement uses dispersal orders to force people to leave an area. Now, wait a second here. I don't like where you're going with this, Attorney General. I don't like the idea of this at all, because the minute you kick all the journalists out, then it's basically you and anyone else there and no one can see what you're doing. And I don't know if that's necessarily a good thing. The Minneapolis Police Department and the State Patrol are trying to deny the motion, saying that the protests both last year and this week created unprecedented, chaotic, and at times destructive civil unrest, which required dispersal orders. Now, once again, I want to make sure I say this. I have seen footage of journalists getting attacked here. And the footage I am seeing is of journalists standing there, clearly marked as media, not throwing rocks, not throwing bottles, taking pictures, interviewing people with a microphone. And I am seeing police specifically target those people. That's unacceptable. And so are you saying then if you cuddle up to the police, that if you're on the other side of the police line, that they'll let you cover it then, but only if you're doing it the way the police want you to cover it? Well, that's not a good idea either. In the motion for a temporary restraining order, six journalists and the Communication Workers of America union says they and other media are targeted by police during the summer George Floyd protests. Minneapolis PD and State Patrol said that journalists put themselves in danger by remaining in the dispersal area as protesters got violent. Otherwise known as doing their job. If your point is, I mean, once again, here is another reason why I don't really trust a lot of police right now with any kind of weapon, whether that's crowd dispersal or a gun. You shouldn't be firing it off willy-nilly at all of them. We're going to get them all. We're getting all of them. We don't care. That shouldn't be your mantra. That shouldn't be your goal. I mean, clearly the people that are throwing rocks and bricks and stuff like that. Yeah, you can't have that kind of civil unrest. But a person sitting there taking photos, that should not be the person you're hitting. And trust me, these media people are not in the middle of these violent groups. You actually are targeting people on the sides, on the wings, that are not in the middle of these groups per se. During the protest in Brooklyn Center on Monday, police and National Guard issued dispersal orders to the media, herding them into a new coverage location near the police station, but some did not comply. The governor's executive order mission Monday, which created nightly curfews, exempted media from the curfew but didn't exempt them from orders from law enforcement. Ellison's office argues no one, including curfew-exempted members of the media, is entitled to remain in an area subject to lawful dispersal order. Yeah, you guys might want to rethink that one. Let the media do their job and stop shooting stuff at them. That's not your problem right now. It, trust me, that's not. Hour two. Jack Rice up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. One quick note before we get to Jack Rice here. I want to say this. It brings up more questions on Kim Potter shooting Dante Wright. Once again, when I looked at the Glock 17 that they had there and I was looking at the safety features, the safety's on the trigger. I didn't see an additional button you had to switch. But if that is the case, then once again, how in the world did you pull that weapon, flip off the safety, and then pull the trigger if you didn't intend to do that? Because that's not what you do with a taser. And so, I mean, that actually brings up, if there is a switch, I did not see it, and I look back on the image I see, the safety is on the trigger, which is insanity. So that's something that if there is an additional switch on that Glock, then how in the world did you switch off the safety, then pull the trigger? Because that doesn't make any sense then why Dante Wright is currently dead. 952-946-6205. Jack Rice, jackricelaw.com, jackricelaw.com. He's been a very busy man this week. Jack, I really do appreciate the time. I know how busy you are. Thank you very much, sir.
Are you kidding me? If I have the time, man, you're my guy. You know that.
Thank you, Jack. I appreciate it. So we had a busy week here. They wrapped up the prosecution's presentation. The defense took the stage, and they wrapped up their presentation. What did you think about the defense presentation after all we saw from the prosecution?
Well, you know, I mean, the difficult part in a case like this, Matt, is that the prosecution did a heck of a job. I mean, they just did. They had really sharp people. You think about that doc out of Chicago.
Yes.
You think about some of the use of force people, and you look at how effective they were. As you and I have discussed, a big part of this was a combination of not just the issue of bringing in this technical evidence that's really powerful intellectually. You bring in this visceral evidence from his girlfriend, from his younger brother, from eyewitnesses. I mean, it's just ripping at your heartstrings. You combine those two, and it is absolutely devastating testimony. So for the defense, the real question becomes, what do you do? Now, if you think about what they did, this is the struggle. And trust me, as a trial lawyer, this is something I'm constantly having to deal with. It's the question of how much do you present to a jury versus making sure that the jury focuses in on what the prosecution has done. Because remember, the burden is on the state in this case. What they decided to do was to bring in this use of force expert. And they bring in this doc, and basically these are two experts of their own with a bunch of long letters after their names. And the argument to the jury is, look, these seem like reasonable people. These reasonable people seem to disagree. If it's a tie, the defense wins. That actually is the argument.
But okay, and Fowler was the medical guy. I can't remember the crime scene guy, but the procedure guy. But the Fowler was the medical guy. The dismantling of Fowler by the prosecution on cross was unbelievable. And like I said, yeah, you're right. The defense allowed him to put out a lot of ifs and whats and stuff. But the systematic dismantling of his credentials, his arguments by the prosecution, in my mind, negated both of those experts.
No, there is no question. And see, that really is the exposure question. When you start putting on somebody that's dubious, somebody who doesn't necessarily have the expertise that you want and need them to have, what it actually has the potential of doing is undercutting all of your credibility that you may have been able to gain when you're cross-examining the prosecution witnesses. And then, of course, there is the bottom line piece, and that's the question of whether or not you ever put on your own client. There is always that question. There is always a wonder about whether or not you're supposed to, because, you know, there is this presumption of innocence, this idea that they have already said, I did not do it. And so putting them on also exposes them to cross-examination. Sometimes it's because they don't speak particularly well and they might hurt themselves, not because they're guilty, but simply because they're not terribly articulate. Other times it's because they're guilty and you don't want them to say anything stupid. So, because the burden is always on the state. So the bottom line becomes that. But I should say this. I would never put on a client ever, 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 if I thought they were going to lie. And I tell every single client I've ever had this point is that if you're going to take the stand, I am not going to put you on the stand if you're going to go up there and say something that I don't believe to be true. And so that's a part of it.
And I mean, let's face it, in the case of Derek Chauvin, if he would have taken the stand, he would have been destroyed by the prosecution. I mean, it would have been a nightmarish decision by the defense to put him on the stand.
Well, you know, and you're right. And here's the thing is again, as I consider these issues, if I have a client who has basically a clean background, that's a good reason. Chauvin, relatively speaking, the problem is he has a whole bunch of police misconduct questions. And all those have the potential of coming up if he comes out and says, I'm this great guy, and they can now bring in all the things that show that he's not. That's a big part of it. But in his case in particular, the problem that you have is you get to put on this tape. You get to bring on all of these people, and you get to go through it with a microscope with him, literally frame by frame by frame. It's like, okay, now we're at 1 minute and 37 seconds. You're thinking this right now. Now you're at 1 minute and 42 seconds. I mean, it would be absolutely brutal.
Jack, with your legal expertise, as you watch this and read about this over the last week, if you are to give, let's take the devil's advocate side of this. If you are to give the defense their best option here of what you heard to get a not guilty, what did they present? Do you feel could end up getting them a not guilty verdict?
Well, this is where I would be right now. If you look at this case and what came out from the prosecution, from the defense, during cross, all of it, I think the focus right now is going to have to be on, and this sounds crazy, this idea needs to be on proof beyond a reasonable doubt. That is the standard. What that means in a courtroom is not a capricious doubt, not any inconceivable doubt, but it's doubt that you use in your most important affairs. So what that means is, like, if you're deciding whether you're going to put your parents in a nursing home, how careful will you be when you make that decision? When you think about every piece, if you have a question, any question about this case, that question leads to a doubt, a reasonable doubt. And if you can find any room as to why it is that this could have happened any other way, and you're unhappy with some of the evidence or any piece of evidence that the prosecution presented, that is considered doubt. And I think they have to drive that home. They got to beat that drum from beginning to end. They have to. They have no other choice.
If you're the prosecution, your closing argument's just the 9.5-minute videotape, mainly, correct?
You know, I'm tempted, if I'm prosecuting this case, to walk up there with a big giant clock. They've seen the tape how many times? What do you think, Matt?
Overall,
over and over and over again. They've seen it so many times. I would be tempted to walk up there with a big, giant sort of analog sweeping finger clock and just put the clock on in front of them and turn it on and let it go 9 minutes and 29 seconds and just sit there with not a single word. Not a single word. And you just let those seconds slide by and just stare at them in dead silence. And, oh, boy, I don't know. I'm getting shivers thinking about how brutal that would be. If I'm on the defense side, I'm like, okay, I'll be under the table over here in the corner in a fetal position. Yeah. Please just ignore me.
You know, you have been very straightforward. Juries make the decision on this. We really can't say where this is going to go. But if you were to take a guess, and no one's going to hold this to you, if you are going to take a guess, do you think that the prosecution put forward enough evidence here to get guilty on second degree, third degree, and manslaughter?
I want to say the state certainly put together sufficient evidence to do that. You can see how much I'm equivocating now.
Yes.
thanks, brother. I would say they have presented sufficient evidence. At the same time, I think that jurors still want to believe that the cops are the good guys, even when they're not. And I think because of that, you could see a hung jury on the second degree count in particular. Mm-hmm. You might even see a hung jury on the third degree count. I think that he's going to go down on the manslaughter count.
What's the amount of time in jail for manslaughter?
Manslaughter presumptive 48-month commit. That means he would serve a third off for good time. Now, here's the deal. 48 months because of special circumstances in this case, they could try to convince the judge because he was a cop, he did what he did, to go for a double upward, which means 96 months. So he's looking at 8 years with a third off, so he dropped two, he'd do 6 in custody.
I would have a hard time, and I mean, I you are the expert. I'm just the observer here. I think that for sure they got the third degree on him. I really do.
No, I mean, look, they brought up a couple of things in particular during some of that witness testimony. And in particular, I'm thinking back to that cardiologist and the doctor who said, this is when the light goes out of his eyes.
Tobin, you know what I mean? Tobin,
This is when he dies, right there. And the thing is that to watch Chauvin continue, despite the fact that he's kneeling on a dead man, was so brutal that I think that's the third degree count. If they grab him, they grab him because Tobin literally picked up Chauvin and shook him like a rag doll.
And one final thing, reminder, if it's third degree murder, what's the jail's term on that?
Presumptive 150-month commit. It's as bad as the second degree is.
Okay.
So it's a very long time, and so if he goes down on the third degree, you could see that they could still go for an upward. But even 150 months is a long time, regardless.
Jack, we will get closing arguments. I will definitely try to get in touch with you next week to see if you can come back. Okay.
I'm whatever you need, my friend.
Thank you. JackRiceLaw.com. If you need a lawyer, best defense lawyer in town, period, is Jack Rice. JackRiceLaw.com. JackRiceLaw.com. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Jack Rice, absolutely outstanding. I think it's interesting that he put forward, the manslaughter, I think is almost a guarantee. I mean, I got to tell you the truth. I would be shocked beyond shocked if manslaughter is not the guarantee. I actually think it's a pretty solid guarantee the third degree murder. If he doesn't get the second degree murder, it's as Jack said, it's because there's someone on that jury that just does not feel a cop should ever face the same charges that we would if we were in the same situation. That would be it, because I got to tell you the truth. I would be flummoxed. I will be flummoxed if they don't get him on all three. That defense was atrocious. That was just me. And Jack's right. Jack is right. Jack, how many times have I said that in my life? Jack is right. It's the jury. So what you and I think doesn't matter. It's what those 12 people are going to think. Yeah. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Minnesota coronavirus update for today. Half of Minnesotans eligible for COVID-19 vaccine have received at least a first dose. Yay! Half of the Minnesotans have gotten at least their first dose. That's good news. State health officials commended the progress but said more vaccinations are needed amid a third pandemic wave in order to bring Minnesota to a level of herd immunity that stifles the coronavirus, which causes COVID-19. We really, truly are in a race against time to get Minnesotans protected, said State Health Commissioner Jan Malcolm. The Minnesota Department of Health reported 6 more COVID-19 deaths on Friday, 2,299 infections, bringing the state totals to 6,995 and 552,117 infections. The sign of hope in this latest wave is that COVID-19 deaths have not increased over the past month at the same rate as infections and hospitalizations, possibly because many high-risk individuals have been vaccinated. I think that's a pretty safe bet. The state on Friday reported that nearly 2.2 million Minnesotans 16 and older had received COVID-19 vaccine, 50% of the eligible population, and more than 1.5 million had completed one or two dose series. Nearly 85% of senior citizens have received vaccine, a key priority group that has suffered 89% of Minnesota's COVID-19 deaths. The new Mayo Clinic modeling research suggests that Minnesota would be in a much worse situation without vaccine because of reduced compliance with prevention measures and broader circulation of more infectious variants, which is what, kids sports and spring breaks. Had vaccine not existed, Minnesota might have seen a peak of more than 800 patients with COVID-19 needing hospitalization and intensive care in this third wave, more than double the record 399 ICU patients on December 1 during the second wave. It's difficult to untangle how much of this elevated rate of spread right now is due to new variants as opposed to changes in social behavior, the authors wrote in the study released online Thursday. Regardless, by the reason, the absence of vaccinations in the current environment would have been likely a result in a far larger surge to date. I want to remind everyone right now, when Joe Biden took office, there was no vaccines. There was a vaccine, but the federal government hadn't stockpiled any, nor had really gotten any order. It seems as if, and now the more you read about it, it seems as if that Trump had basically, anytime the government got an order in, he'd call one of his buddies and says, hey, have you got donations down there for me? Okay, I'm going to send you some vaccine. That seems to be the way it was going. There was no vaccines when Biden took over. There was no infrastructure plan to distribute them, nor was there any infrastructure in place to distribute them. The fact we are at this point right now is very commendable to Joe Biden and to Governor Walz. And once again, we got a little bit of an issue going on with some of these things going on right now. But Governor Walz, on COVID, you did a pretty darn amazing job. Let's see here. Had all vaccination activity ceased on April 6th, the most likely scenario under the modeling, that is, Minnesota would have come close to 300 COVID-19 ICU admissions. If Minnesota had magically reached the 75% vaccination rate on that date, the modeling suggests the viral activity and hospital usage quickly would dissipate. So it's the vaccines are helping. I should mention about 11% of Minnesotans are hesitant about getting the COVID-19 vaccine, one of the lowest rates in the nation, according to a federal survey. Vaccine hesitancy rates in Wyoming is 31%. A third of the state of Wyoming will not. That the coronavirus will haunt Wyoming for decades. 7% in Vermont and Massachusetts. Minnesota rate is among the nation's 6th lowest. Suggests the state may be able to reach 80% vaccination, a goal set by Governor Walz, herd immunity. The survey conducted by the U.S. Census Bureau between March 3rd and 15th asked respondents if they would definitely, probably, or definitely not get the vaccine once it was available to them. Respondents who said probably or definitely not were counted as vaccine hesitant. About 5% of the Minnesotans said they would definitely not get vaccinated. Another 6% said they would probably get vaccinated. Health officials are ramping up efforts to encourage more Minnesotans to get vaccinated. I mean, what's it going to be? You are going to have most people not getting sick. And my guess is going to be what's going to push some of these communities over is where this 11% is there. And I think we can honestly say that in more conservative parts of the state, it's probably closer to 20-25%. In more liberal parts of the state, it's probably less, like 5%, maybe this. we get to say Christmas. Say we get a lot of people vaccinated. We go through the summer. And say all of a sudden at Thanksgiving and Christmas, one small town out in rural Minnesota all of a sudden has 50 cases of coronavirus. You've got people dying again. Well, I guarantee you all of a sudden those people are going to be like, when no one else seems to be getting it at the level they are, they'll be running to get their vaccinations. So 11% is pretty low. Actually, I'm pretty surprised Minnesota's that low. But you know what? Everyone get a vaccination. You get up to 80%, we're going to be looking pretty good in the state. Although variants the disease are a little concerned. Let's take a break right now, and we'll come on back. We've got Brett Johnson with an interview. When we do return, it is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Oh, it's okay. There you go. Now it's Matt McNeil. We got a little bit of a technical issue here. Patrick is on fire. Just stop, drop, and roll, my friend. Stop, drop, and roll. All right? It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. It is a Friday. It means we usually check in. Brett Johnson, here's an interview he did with Andrew Gordon of the Legal Rights Center. He's talking about protester rights. Very appropriate for right now where we're at. It's Brett Johnson right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Friday afternoon. We're joined now by Andrew Gordon. He is an attorney and the deputy director of the Community Legal Services for the Legal Rights Center, as he's someone who has represented many demonstrators and protesters over the years, as we're going to be chatting about some of the demonstrations we've seen the past few nights and what some of the rights are of people who do go out and demonstrate and protest. So, Andrew Gordon, really appreciate you taking the time today. Like we were talking about off air, I'm sure you're very busy, and do want to thank you again for joining me here on the show today.
No, I appreciate the invitation. I'm happy to be here.
Absolutely. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into organizing mass defense of demonstrators charged with crimes. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, I went to law school specifically to work most directly with individuals coming from marginalized communities and folks who specifically were too poor to afford an attorney. I'd always wanted to be a public defender. And that's a large part of that is based on kind of my own family background and history with the court system. And so when I was presented with the opportunity, first back after the killing of Jamar Clark and the organizing that came up after that, I kind of fell into this work very happily, actually, because it afforded me an opportunity to work with people who were activists, they were advocates, they were willing to push and put their bodies on the line for change. And I wanted to be able to support that work in any way, shape, or form that I could. And that support has continued through the years, and most recently then with support for protesters last year during the uprising, and currently for protesters who are outside the Brooklyn Center Police Department the last four nights.
So how are you personally feeling after seeing, unfortunately, another case of an unarmed black man being killed by police? That would, of course, be Dante Wright from this past weekend. What are your feelings so far?
I mean, I think like a lot of people, especially folks who look like me, you know, we're tired. There's a certain level of frustration and anger, and you see some of that manifested, I think, in the street as people protest, and you saw a lot of that manifested last year. There's not necessarily a lot of hope because we don't see the type of systemic change that we think is necessary to correct the issues that continue to plague Minnesota, that continue to plague America, et cetera. And so there is, I'm not going to say necessarily hopelessness, but there certainly is waning hope that enough people care deeply enough about these topics and these issues that we see systemic change. Because, you know, our bodies are on the line, and we're being shot, we're being harassed, we're being killed, and that takes a toll on people.
What do protesters and demonstrators often tell you about why they're out and demonstrating? Because a lot of times it is kind of an expression of grief and trauma from what they're experiencing in their community that is tough for people who isn't a person of color to really, I don't know how to put it, kind of understand what might be happening in their own communities.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. It's generally, I think, an expression of grief. It's an expression of trauma. The way I think about it and what I've heard from people is that it's a mechanism of processing that trauma
and of coping with the grief and the frustration and the anger, right? People are in the street because they have for a long time been kept voiceless. They've for a long time been disempowered. They don't necessarily have access to the ballot box. They don't necessarily have access to their elected officials. In this specific case, right, we don't have access to the Brooklyn Center Police Department. We don't have access to the people who are coordinating or planning Operation Safety Net. And so absent that access, absent that ability to sit at a table and to talk with people about the issues that plague our lives and their lives, this protest, getting into the streets, shouting, carrying signs, etc., that's how people get heard, right? And so in addition to the processing that I think goes on with respect to the trauma, to the frustration and the grief, there is also, I think, a distinct element of this is how we make ourselves heard on these topics, because otherwise people don't care and people don't listen.
So going back to when, unfortunately, we had the murder of George Floyd, comparing what we saw last summer to what we've been seeing this spring in terms of the demonstrating, have we seen any changes from police tactics at these demonstrations? Talk about that aspect a little bit from what you've seen.
I mean, I think we have seen a slight change, and it's not a change for good. It's funny because, you know, a lot of people ask me questions about, do we think law enforcement or the state or the city has learned anything from last summer's uprising? And I think they have, but I think they learned the wrong thing, right? So last summer, you saw a distinct mobilization of a lot of police officers and a lot of law enforcement agencies working in conjunction. They figured out kettling very well. They figured out how they wanted to like set up a structure in order to authorize the use of chemical munitions, non-lethal munitions, etc. And I think what we're seeing demonstrated over the last few nights is that they took those lessons, the lessons of how to organize their response, and they're implementing those lessons here now. What they haven't seemed to learn is that protests are expressions of grief, that they're expressions of frustration, that the protest itself, even if it seems unruly, even if people are shouting or doing things that they may not like, that those protests would largely remain not violent, they would largely remain peaceful, and people would say their piece and then likely go home, but for the escalation from law enforcement. And they haven't seemed to learn the connection and the lesson of how that escalation plays into some of the scenes that we've seen over the last four nights, and that we will probably likely see again when we get a verdict in the Chauvin trial.
Yeah, unfortunately, I think you're right. And what, at least in your mind, do you think law enforcement could do differently to de-escalate these situations? Because I like that term you use, because oftentimes, at least when I'm seeing what's happening, it does look like sometimes it is the police who are escalating these situations and making the situations worse. So what could the police do or law enforcement do to try to de-escalate some of the situations?
Well, I think I'll give you a really easy example from last night, right? Last night, the protesters had developed kind of a mechanism. They wanted to be able to get close to the barricades, the wired barricades at the Brooklyn Center Police Department. And so folks had put up umbrellas in order to shield themselves from the use of marking rubber rounds. And it would have been really nice if, in response to that, I think the gathered law enforcement simply said, you know what? We're not going to use marker rounds. We're not going to shoot them against the umbrellas. We're not going to use flashbangs. We're not going to use tear gas and other chemical irritants. Because we're going to allow the protesters the space and the ability, even if it means giving them the ability to get right up to the barricade, to have their space and to say their piece. Except what you see is, and what we saw last night, is that you saw folks trying to get up to the barricade and you saw law enforcement responding with flashbangs, with rubber bullets, and with tear gas, because they just didn't want people in that space, right? The folks who were protesting would have been on the other side of the barricade. They weren't a threat to law enforcement, but they were responded to as if they were. And I think that's part of the problem. What I would want law enforcement to do is not to respond to protesters as if they were a threat.
Do you think attitudes have changed about protesting from the perspective of the general public over the past year or so, especially here in the Twin Cities, from what people saw after the murder of George Floyd and seeing a lot of members of their community going out and protesting. Do you think those attitudes of protesting have changed over the past few, or is it kind of largely the same?
This is going to be a weird response. I'm a little bit biased here because in the course of the last year, I have had more conversations with people who I would never have expected to be on the street protesting than I have had in the previous 8 or 9 years of my practice. And what that tells me is that there is a growing awareness amongst what I would call ordinary Minnesotans, right? People who traditionally would not necessarily be directly impacted by police violence. But there's been a growing awareness amongst those ordinary Minnesotans that these issues are intrinsic, that they're systematic, that they are serious, and that they have a deleterious impact on members of our community, such that ordinary Minnesotans should step up and do something. And I think those conversations I've been having more and more, and they continue to be eye-opening, because I think it signals to me that there has been a slight sea change in how people view the act of protest, and not just the act of protest, but the necessity behind it.
We're speaking with Andrew Gordon. He is the Deputy Director of Community Legal Services for the Legal Rights Center, as over the past several years, he's represented many people who have been arrested that have been protesting and demonstrating. As we're talking about his background and a little bit about protesting and what we've seen the past few days and also over the past year plus. So as you were talking about seeing an increase in more ordinary Minnesotans going out and protesting, or maybe people who are white who normally wouldn't go out and protest, if someone is going out for the first time to attend one of these demonstrations, what should they at least be prepared for legally if they do happen to get arrested?
So if they're arrested and actually detained, so because they're very different types of arrest that are typically involved, right? Either they're going to be detained, cited, and released, which generally is the large majority of people who get arrested at these types of protests and demonstrations. And to the extent of what you should expect if that's the case, expect to be sat down for 2 to 3 hours, probably uncomfortably on the side of the street or on a bus. While you're processed. So at times, police officers will take photographs, they'll take your name, they'll take your address, they'll issue you a citation, and then they'll release you. And then the question we sometimes have is where that release occurs. Is it on the side of the road? Is it at 3 o'clock in the morning? Is it at an actual police station where you have access to the resources to get home, for example? And so you should be making plans for all of those things. Make sure that there are people who you can contact if you are arrested. Make sure you have a method and a way to communicate to those individuals where you are, and if anything, where you'll be released. You always want to make sure that other people know what's going on and where you are. And you generally will be given the opportunity to make a phone call. Most people can keep their cell phones, for example, especially if they're detained on a bus. If, however, you're taken to, for example, the public safety facility and you're detained at a jail, the ability to contact people is going to be significantly circumscribed. You're going to have to wait until you're given permission to do so, but you're still going to want to follow the same basic plan. You're going to want to contact people and inform them where you are, that you have been detained, that you're in custody at somewhere like the public safety facility. You're going to want to have people check on you. And that's some of the work that my organization and the people that we work with do when people are detained, when people are arrested, especially when they're held at a jail. We're going to send in attorneys and advocates to talk to them, to check in on them, to make sure they're okay, and then to be able to update their friends and families as to what's going on, and then to organize, for example, release and bail. But the idea going into it is that if you think you're going to be arrested or detained, you have to have a plan for how you're going to get the information of that arrest out to people. You're obviously going to want to also walk with as little as possible, you know, don't carry your whole life on you if you think you're going to get arrested. Keep it to the bare minimum. And just prepare for the time it's going to take and the interruption to your life that detention is going to result in.
So what sorts of interruptions in someone's life could they expect, at least beyond the arrest, in terms of the legal charges they might be facing and how they might have to interact with the court system? What does that look like after they've been booked and then eventually released by the police?
Yeah, if you do end up charged, and, you know, we're talking about run-of-the-bill, let's say misdemeanor, unlawful assembly, trespass, obstruction legal process, very kind of low level offenses that we typically see, you're going to have to kind of settle in for a long process. A large number of people who were charged in cases last year have been to court once or twice now and have not yet gotten the opportunity to exercise their right to a trial because the timeline for resolving these cases is often protracted. It takes a lot longer than you ordinarily would think. It's going to require time for you to go to court. It's going to require you time to review evidence. It's going to require the time and resources potentially to hire an attorney, although there are options for that. It can serve as a significant disruption to people, especially if you are undocumented, especially if you are subject to license requirements for your occupation that would otherwise require you to report any contact with law enforcement, any arrests or any charges. So it has the ability to obviously impact housing situations, etc. There are a whole, I think, list of consequences that come from even low-level charges and even just an arrest related to protests that folks should really think about and consider prior to going out and protesting, especially if you intend or do get arrested.
And what recourse do people have if they're being mistreated by the police or if they see other demonstrators being mistreated by the police? What sorts of actions can they take?
There are a few actions. I don't necessarily know that any of them are particularly good, except to say we continue, and I will always advocate and advise people to document any police misconduct to the best of your ability. Always try to go in groups of people. So if you're getting arrested, someone else is there to record. Pull out your phones, pull out cameras, take videos, take pictures. It is always a good idea to be able to identify which law enforcement agency you're interacting with, because it makes a difference as to kind of what happens next. Are you interacting with the Hennepin County Sheriff's Department? Are you interacting with Brooklyn Center Police Department, Minneapolis Police Department, et cetera? You need to know that. You need to have some basic information about that. There's a complaint process for all of these law enforcement agencies that we advise people to take advantage of. The complaint process is very long and doesn't always get you where you need to be, but I think it's a necessary element of what the response looks like. But then there's also kind of an in-court response. If someone was charged, but there was police misconduct leading up to that charge, that's obviously something that can play a role in the ultimate resolution or disposition of their case. And it's something that something like me, you know, a defense attorney is going to look at and is going to kind of play around with as we're crafting a defense and as we're crafting a response to the charges itself.
And final question here for you, Andrew. Let's say someone does end up in some legal trouble from demonstrations that have been happening. How can they get a hold of you or the Legal Rights Center for representation?
Sure. You can visit us on our website. It's www.legalrightscenter.org. You can call me, 612-677-2137. You can email me, agordon, A-G-O-R-D-O-N, at legalrightscenter.org.
And that's Andrew Gordon. He is the Deputy Director of Community Legal Services for the Legal Rights Center, as we've been talking about some of the demonstrations we've seen over the past few days and even going back to last year and beyond. Andrew Gordon, again, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. Very informative interview and appreciate it.
Thank you very much for the invitation again. I'm happy to help and to talk where I'm needed.
All right, we'll take a break, turn things back over to Matt McNeil up next on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, is the Matt McNeil Show. I got some music coming up here in just a moment here. But I got one or two more stories here to get to before we get to the end of the show. An update on our good friends at the Alibi Drinkery in Lakeville. Oh, good friends. Now, to say that this place has had some interesting moments over the last few months is an understatement. One of the co-owners, Yosemite Sam, did out his window with two guns and open fire. Did he open fire on the police? Do you remember? Was that actually like he actually fired on them?
I can't remember if he opened fire. I just remember the jumping out the window with the guns.
With the guns. Pulled the Yosemite Sam. Then he went up and beat up. Didn't he beat up the guy at a Jimmy John's or something like that?
I don't remember that.
I said mayo, damn it.
Dude, I'm not saying you've got some anger issues, but I'm saying something's wrong. Needless to say, I believe he's the co-owner of this bar. The other embattled owner of Alibi Drinkery in Lakeville, who defied Governor Walz's order closing bars and restaurants amid the pandemic last winter, has been denied a liquor license for yet another establishment, this time in Northfield. The Northfield City Council denied Lisa Monet Zarza's request for a liquor license renewal at Alibi at Foggy Bottoms, 4-3 vote at a meeting last week. Boy, that does sound just like it just sounds like Alibi at Foggy Bottoms. Oh, God. For me, this really boiled down to doing what was best interest of this public health. City Council member Claire Garbeau said in an interview on Thursday, she voted to deny the liquor license. In a report to the council, Northfield Police Chief Mark Elliott recommended denying Zarza's liquor license, saying the issuing one wouldn't be in the public interest due to Zarza's executive order violations at the Lakeville location. He also noted it should be denied because Zarza wasn't a person of good moral character and repute. Damn! He actually put that in the report. Both qualifiers is listed in the state statute as reasons to deny a liquor license. Zarza said on Thursday that it was frustrating to see a decision based on the chief's recommendation when he's not an elected official. She also pushed back on his questioning of her moral character. Really? Good luck in that fight. Good luck there. It was a far reach for them to refuse to issue a liquor license based on governmental mandate that we didn't violate it, that Northfield location, she said. Councilmember Jessica Peterson White said she was struggling on how to vote because she valued civil disobedience as an important path to social change in our country's history. However, it's a privilege to be granted a liquor license, she said, because serving alcohol can result in the death. Well, thank God you came around on that one. She said Elliott's report showed that it was an unreasonable to assume Zarza was responsible enough to sell liquor in the community. She voted to deny the license. City Council member Susie Nikasian noted the dangerous situation created by COVID-19, but she favored granting the license. Since there has been no violation locally, I feel comfortable issuing this temporary license and with the hope that the owner will prove able to submit to the law. Funny story. When council members asked Zarza, she intended to comply with the executive orders in Northfield. She said she was going to. The saga began in December. The Department of Public Safety notified Zarza at its intention of suspend her liquor license because Alibi Drinkery in Lakeville was open despite its statewide order closing bars and restaurants. She said that she would close Alibi, but state officials witnessed patrons eating and drinking there on dates throughout December and January. A judge found her in contempt of court in January. On March 26, an administrative law judge upheld the state's move to revoke her liquor license for that establishment for 5 years. So that one's gone. I mean, I can't see how she survives. Let's face it. I mean, is anyone really going to Alibi for anything but drinking? You know, I'm serious. So you take away what's your main, if the booze is gone, what's your main appeal there? I've never heard of anyone saying, well, their onion rings are delicious. I haven't heard anything like that. So the Lakeville liquor license decision isn't final for 90 days or until the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety issues a public ruling. According to Elliott's report in the council, if the state revokes the license, Zarza will not be allowed to hold a liquor license anywhere in the state of Minnesota. At the April 6th Northfield City Council meeting, Zarza explained her decision to open her Lakeville restaurant despite the statewide order, citing her belief, the U.S. Constitution, her Christian beliefs, her staff's desire to work, and her assertion that restaurants and bars have been unfairly targeted. Her defiance was to disseminate how Walz was infringing on citizens' basic rights, she said. Okay. She comes on out there, says, I'm going to comply, but then spends, you know, a good chunk of her time speaking, talking about how they're big government out of control. I think it was the right call not to give her a liquor license. I'm a Christian. Okay, this is Zarza saying this. I'm a Christian. Okay, pardon me a second. Pardon me, I'm back. Where's I? Zarza saying, I'm a Christian, and I believe in our rights now are being taken away from us as Americans, as you see it across the board in so many areas. Alibi at Foggy Bottoms, which Zarza started in 2019, can remain open and serve just food. Yum. Zarza said it's open Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays on Facebook post dated April 13th. So the city council's split the decision to grant the liquor license, so we have no alcohol, but we're not letting them win. Well, I got news for you. They didn't split it. It was a majority against giving you a liquor license. And, well, they won. That's, I think we're... And scene. All right. We ready, Patrick, with the music here? There we go. Ray Charles. A Fool for You, taking us out this week. You have a good week and keep your head together, okay? We'll get through this together, all right? I'm back on a Monday. Till then, see ya.
That you didn't want me. You didn't love me no more. I wanna know. Oh, what makes me be? Do you believe me, child? I'm a fool for you. Oh. Just about to break a day. Reach over and feel a pillow. Mm-hmm. Where your baby used to lay. Then you put on your crown. Like you never cried before. Oh, Lord. Yeah, you leave it crying so loud. You'll give the blues to your neighbor next door. Ever since you were 5 years old, baby, I've been a fool for you, little girl. Way down in my soul, I'm a little fool for you. So I know it's something.